From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter, no Stuart, which means this episode will probably feature 110% less racial humor.
Family friendly.
There's John Grace over there. Hi, yeah. John.
Hi.
What's new in your world?
Just cutting back on the heavy lifting.
I'm cutting up on the heavy lifting. I'm going.
You probably need to. But I did like 2 months of HIIT training, and you know, just going in like once or twice a week to the gym and just feeling like crap for a couple of days.
Yeah,
because I was lifting so heavy.
I fell off for like a couple of months, and now I'm like, I'm going back into it. I'm not making it like this thing that I'm thinking about all the time. So it's not something I'm going into the pain and getting burned out on.
I am switching to high volume.
How so?
Like I'm doing like 8 sets of 8. So you go to what you do is you go to lighter weights.
Okay.
And I concentrate more on cardio, and I'm actually got the 20-minute Rodney Yee yoga DVD out and everything to get some mobility back. So I'm stiff. You know,
that's one thing.
Sharp pain in my hips. Yeah. You definitely. They talk about weightlifting making you stiff. Technically, it doesn't, but it actually kind of does.
I want to start is yoga. I want to go to yoga classes. Like, that's one thing I'm going, okay, I would like to do that. I'd like to try it out.
The thing about yoga classes is they are good. They go for about an hour. If you're trying to meet women, it's a great way to meet women.
Well, I've heard that, and that's a side. That's something okay on the side. Great, you know, that's a good way to meet chicks. Because meeting chicks, I don't want to meet girls at a bar or anything like that. You know, it's not a good way to meet women.
At least at yoga, you're going to meet them with, you know, they got some health in mind. You know, long
exactly.
Long-term.
You know, you're meeting them in a healthy environment as opposed to an unhealthy one.
But I do think the best thing to do is to find like a 10 or 15 or 20 minute yoga workout DVD, and you can buy DVDs now that have like 5 different.
So DDP yoga. Thinking?
I like DDP yoga, and he's got a different variety. It can be expensive for some people. You could go buy like a Rodney Yee DVD for like $10 at a grocery store. Like they're pretty big out there. I've seen them at Big Lots for like $3, and I think I found mine at a Safeway that was going out of business, and I bought it for like $4 or $3. But I like the DDP yoga as well. But what he's doing isn't 100% like yoga, but it's great.
Like, he markets it as like yoga for dudes. You know, this is
I mean, it's more macho, and it's not new agey, and you don't hear the new age synth music and the Zamfir type crap. And he doesn't talk about the third eye. You know, it's DDP being real, you know, macho. This is yoga. We say, let's go get a beer, not namaste. But but his workouts are good. Like I enjoy those too. I have a lot of his workouts on disc, and I bought some off eBay. You can buy it sometimes. Buy the old ones real cheap on eBay from one of the official licensed DDP liquidator. And but those workouts are great. Like the early discs are really good. The later ones are good because you put in some dynamic tension stuff, which is a kind of forgotten exercise routine people used to do a lot more like 50 years ago. And they're all pretty good. But I think if you find like just if you just get a 10-minute wake up yoga disc, it's worth it to get your mobility back. Because, dude, I was just like, man, my flexibility, mobility just kind of sucks right now. And I realized it's because I'm lifting heavy. And, you know, I said I'm going to train more with the go to the high volume and tone down the weights a little and try to get toned, you know, just try to get the fat down a bit, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm focusing on.
Because I always feel better. You know, I felt my best when I weigh like 170 pounds, mm-hmm. and I'm a bit off from that right now. So it's like, okay, it's time to kind of try to go back to that look.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a journey.
Yeah. And for me, it's I don't care about what I look like or whatever. It's just I want to feel better, you know.
Well, that's ultimately the part of it, especially like, you know, you're a married man, you know, you're not it's not like you're out there trying to attract a mate.
I don't have to go to the neighborhood pool and try to attract, you know, the pool bunnies and stuff.
Pool
you know,
bunnies
in summertime, you know, oh, whatever geez. The hell you'd call them now. Pool. You know, trying to be like you know, guy in a Frankie Avalon movie.
No, I know.
Who's trying to steal Annette Funicello from Frankie.
Good God. So, you and Stuart are always saying how I'm the young guy on the show, but I turned 30 this week.
Oh, yeah, welcome to 30.
I mean, I'm
now.
still the young guy on the show, but I'm 30.
See,
now
you could talk shit about 20 somethings.
I know. Like, now really I have something. A guy actually came to my door and he handed me a card. He said, "Talk shit about 20 somethings."
Well, it's funny because I posted up something yesterday where I said, if I ever start my own Facebook group, I'm going to call it the Grown Man's Kung Fu Discussion Group. And I got something like 15 likes on it. And I got some likes from people who actually, like the guy who produced the last Van Damme movie. That isn't out yet. It hasn't been released.
And I'm sure Ringo Lam liked it too.
I wonder if he's on Facebook. He should be. But
he's not. Get on the stick, Ringo. Jesus.
But I think people like that idea because if you talk about kung fu movies in any discussion group, you get that infantile young guy that got into this because of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh, of course.
Or Dragon the Bruce Lee Story, heaven forbid, which I guess we're going to have to
talk about. What's a newer example of that? Ong Bak?
Yeah, Ong Bak would be a newer one.
Man with the Iron Fists, I don't know.
God, I hope not. But there's also this generation that's probably going to be into it because of The Raid or The Raid 2.
You know what, though? I'm okay with that.
That's at least the two better movies to get into the genre for. But, they're Indonesian. They're not even Hong Kong movies.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. They're from Indonesia. I push those movies on as many people as I can. Because people go, like, I want a good action movie. I'm like, you know, read subtitles, I don't give a shit. Watch these, you know.
Right. Yeah, I just picked them up. I have them on both on Blu-ray, but I haven't even broken the plastic on them.
Yeah, I've
kind of savoring that moment when I just kind of like, okay, I'm going to revisit these again.
Yeah, I've got them both on Blu-ray too, although I do want to do like a double header, like get a friend over who hasn't seen them.
Right.
And just like put them through the Raid ringer, you know. We're going to go through building, and then we're going to go embark on this crime saga with baseball bat-wielding psychos. And you know.
Well, the funny thing is I'm going back. I'm finding myself, because I, you know, as I say again and again on the show to where I'm a broken record, I'm not digging the new stuff too much, not digging new movies overall. I'm not caring.
Man, and I am the same way. Like, I've gone to the movies less this year than I ever have.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I've seen more old movies this year. Like, I saw a Shaw Brothers film, an old one from, like, 82, like, I think it was called Buddha's Palm. And, like, I saw that, and I saw, like, To Have and Have Not, the Bogart Bacall movie at the Alamo Draft House. So it was, like, two old movies I just
William Faulkner wrote that.
Yeah, exactly. And, but lately I've been going back watching a lot of 70s and 80s. Hong Kong movies from what I call the Golden Age, and appreciating more stuff from back then. And I'm trying to get some ideas for some future articles for like Wings Chop and maybe even Exploitation Retrospect.
It's so funny. You go back and watch. There's so many old movies to watch. Why even bother with new movies? Honestly,
I know.
Most of them aren't very good. They're not very memorable. Like, Kino Lorber's been re-releasing movies like crazy on Blu-ray. And a lot of them are movies like I haven't even heard of, and I take them home and I see the cover and I go, that looks cool, and I take it home and watch it. Some of them are movies that I'm well familiar with, but you know, there are just so many movies out there. I see on Netflix, I see on at the store, Warner Archive. You know?
Yeah, I just stopped renewal on my Warner Archives subscription on the Roku channel. Because they're putting up too many Allied Artist movies and their MGM acquirements, which that's not what I subscribed to it for. I wanted some Warner Brothers
stuff. Jesus, I mean, that's been the problem with a lot of the boutique labels. Like, Criterion's had the same problem. I mean, they're releasing, like, deluxe editions of these old MGM titles.
Yeah.
Used to be on, Stranger Than Paradise,
Right.
What was a recent one? Scanners.
Yeah. Yeah, like, what the hell? Who cares? David Cronenberg's movies, even when they're good, they look like shit. It doesn't matter if you put them on Blu-ray, because they're drab-looking Canadian movies.
Right, they're made at the public access stage.
It's like, do something useful and introduce something new to home video buyers in America or North America, and, like, hey, pour it over that Ken Takakura box set from Toei DVD.
Yeah, I mean...
And and put some English subtitles on them. That's all you got to do. The transfers are there. They look great. Just bring them over and let's boost up the Yakuza movie in America.
Yeah, that's the thing is like the Yakuza movies Criterion's put out have been like the really easy ones, like
Branded to Kill, I picked up, but those movies were not considered weirdo ones. That's like saying our label is going to put out the American Westerns and we're going to put out Blazing Saddles and then we're going to put out Waterhole Number 3. It's just like why is Kentucky Akura's best stuff not even available over here? It's crazy. I got to go to gray market dealers who might just sell me Burns for like $8 or $9 with fan subtitles. I hate that. Right. It's like I want that stuff legit.
Criterion puts out their stuff at a much quicker rate now, and they're going for the easy acquisitions. They're not like, I don't know, they're just not putting out I'm buying new titles from them at a lesser rate at this point.
Yeah, I only bought Branded to Kill during the Barnes & Noble sale.
Right.
And I'm a member of the Barnes & Noble thing where I get the extra discount, and I had the coupon, and all I bought was Branded to Kill. I didn't even buy another Criterion.
I think I got My Darling Clementine, trying to see what else.
Which is a good movie.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, anytime there's John Ford, I think I love that film.
In fact, the Terrence Hill American film, Mr. Billions, made explicit references to My Darling Clementine, where I think he's watching it on TV.
And I love Victor Mature, too. I think that was the movie that introduced me to him.
Yeah, he's good in that. It's a good movie. It's a solid Ford Western.
Well, speaking of solid, John. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is a bad transition. I'm not sure. When I was watching this movie, I was thinking, have we talked about this movie on the show before?
Not that I recall.
Okay, because the first time you were on the show, we talked about Bruce Lee movies.
Right.
Did we cover this?
We did not cover it.
We did not, okay.
Because it's not really a Bruce Lee movie, even though there is footage of him in this film.
It's Bruce Bloitation officially sanctioned by Raymond Chow. You know?
Right. It's Raymond Chow basically trying to satisfy Japanese distributors who, Game of Death, the 1978... Robert Klaus disaster.
We have talked about that movie. I know.
Right. That was a huge, that was a big hit in America. It was actually one of the most successful Bruce Lee release in America,
And I was thinking that movie has to be because the image of Bruce in the yellow and black tracksuit is such an iconic image of Bruce, even though he's in that movie for, 5 minutes.
Well, people wanted to see that footage so bad, and it's edited down to 13 minutes. It could have been 45 minutes, but Klaus didn't like the footage, and he edited it down to 13 minutes.
Yeah, I mean,
but anyway.
I think on the, I have the Enter the Dragon thing, and I know you've slammed this thing, but there was that guy, that bodybuilder dude who put together the full cut of...
John Little.
John Little, yes.
Warrior's Journey is actually a better way to watch Game of Death footage than actually watching.
Okay, for some reason I thought you didn't like it or you had problems with it.
I don't like it as much as Bruce Lee and G.O.D., which was a Japanese only production that also used the footage. Mm-hmm. And I think they managed to get I think they actually got Dan Asano to dub his own voice in that. In their footage.
Really?
You have to seek it out. You probably have to get it from Video Pirates. Maybe there's a torrent out there. I got to get a copy of it because it's pretty interesting. And Bay Logan dubbed Bruce Lee's voice. And but it works better. Bay Logan does a better impression of Bruce Lee's voice than John Little. So and it utilizes the footage a lot more convincingly than what Warrior's Journey. John Little is in love with the idea that Bruce was this philosopher king.
Right.
Who
That's
was never
what it,
crowned.
It's a very... Flowery,
yeah,
like
everything
you know.
I've read about Game of Death, there was no big philosophical intent. It was basically going to be like a James Bond movie, except with martial arts, and that's why he was talking to George Lazenby about being in the movie. All that stuff about philosophy was nonsense.
It's that myth that's grown up around Bruce that he's this philosopher warrior,
Right, it's just crazy. And I mean, he never had a legit fight anywhere. And I always say, if you ask me who the toughest guy in Hong Kong is, it's Michael Chen Wai Man during that time. Because Chen Wai Man, who you probably best known as playing the villain in Five Element Ninja, the leader of the ninjas,
Now tell me your name.
Yeah, this guy, Chan Wai Man, proudly displayed his triad tattoos, had triad connections, and while he was starring in movies, he was also competing in the boxing ring. And I'm not just, he competed in Western boxing, and he also competed in, like, kickboxing fights, fighting, like, Muay Thai style. And he had, like, a great record. I don't even know if he had any losses, and I don't know how much was recorded, but he was out fighting all the time. And he'll tell you stories of he never worked with Sammo Hung in the movie industry because he and Sammo got into a fight at a disco, like, in the 70s. And he said they got into a fight, and so he worked with Jackie Chan in, like, Project A2 and Dragon Lord, but he said he and Sammo never worked together because he and Sammo don't like each other.
Awesome.
They got into a brawl at a disco, but he's one of those guys, like, if his student got beat up by a Muay Thai boxer saying Chinese Kung Fu is no good, Chan Wai Man would go challenge the Muay Thai boxer, and Chan Wai Man had trained in Muay Thai, so he picks him on and knocked him out.
So really, really what we're saying here is that Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, really was more similar to the Chan Wai Man story.
Yes, because Chan Wai Man...
would actually go and beat the shit out of these people.
Right, and the funny thing is, like, I went to Chan Wai Man's Facebook page and liked it, and I started following it, and he's been posting photos that I think his daughter has been scanning in. And there's a shot of him, like, when he's a young man, he's ripped. He had one of the best physiques in the Hong Kong film industry. He's built like a boxer, like Bruce Lee.
His physique, like, I thought was striking when I saw Five Element Ninja, which is one of my favorite Shaw Brothers movies. I love that movie.
Yeah, he's a bad dude, and he would show off his workout routine in different movies like The Handcuff, which came out in 79 before actors like Stallone were doing "This Is Me Pumping Iron," you know, the kind of montage of them pumping iron and stuff. He was doing that stuff before anybody else. And
but
like,
did
so this
he
at least...
chase a chicken? Did he catch a chicken?
I don't know, but apparently he owns some fighting chickens. Some fighting roosters.
Oh, damn. So he was in Monty Hellman's The Cockfighter then.
He's apparently a pretty scary guy, and he doesn't shy away. And imagine if we had somebody in Hollywood who, like, boasted about their ties to the mob and was also competing in the UFC and winning and was also starring in movies where they were playing fighters with ties to the mob. That's basically what Chan Wai Man was in Hong Kong.
Like, you hear that, Terry Crews? Fucking get on the stick. What's his name? Randy Couture.
Yeah,
you know.
But he's in movies working out, and he's got these kind of crazy workout routines with weights that you don't see too often. And I read an interview with him where he's like, he believed in lifting lighter, faster, you know, like a boxer would or a fighter. He thought you needed to stay lean. So he posted a photo of him back in the 70s looking rip, and a photo of him today. The guy's got to be like 68 or something. He's still ripped. He's got the same physique. It's scary. Dude,
I gotta like this guy's page.
He's awesome, and he still looks cool. It's like, man, I want to be him when I'm a senior citizen. You know, and he's wearing the boxing gloves, and he's frightening.
It sounds, God, you know, because I always thought, because I can still picture him in my head from Five
Element
Ninja.
Yeah, Chan Wai Man on Facebook. He's just awesome. And, but yeah, it's like,
there we go.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about legit tough guy credibility. He had it, you know.
Unlike Bruce.
And don't get me wrong, I like Bruce, but...
How many shows have we done on Bruce? Like, two?
A lot.
I think we've
technically done two, and then I think we're still going to do Dragon the Bruce Lee story.
Yeah,
so
we got to do that sometime, but...
That's going to be done sometime in the future. That's like 3 years in the making,
I mean,
probably.
Obviously, like, we're big Bruce Lee fans. I was thinking about this earlier. What's your favorite Bruce Lee movie?
It's Way of the Dragon.
Way of the Dragon?
Yeah, which, growing up, that was called Return of the Dragon. But,
yeah.
I think I stated that on the commentary.
I think that one is the best, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. I think it's the best Bruce Lee movie, but, you know, the one I watch the most is Enter the Dragon, probably. But
That one's easier to watch.
Exactly. It's got that crazy comic book style.
Right.
And
because it's a very American film. The set design is actually right out of Terry and the Pirates. They'll even admit it.
Absolutely.
It was inspired by Hong Kong movies. You know?
It's so easy to watch. Like, it's so, you know, you just pop it on, John Saxon, Jim Kelly, Bruce Lee.
Right.
You know, Dr. Claw.
Dr. Han. Or Han. I don't even think he's Doctor.
I know. I just call him Doctor Claw.
Mr. Han.
I was thinking of a Kentucky Fried Movie or whatever.
Right, right. It's the most accessible to Americans. The funny thing is, this movie we're talking about tonight, Game of Death 2, which was basically made for the Japanese market, and
I kind of figured that when I was watching it again. I was watching it thinking it felt like it was aimed there.
Well, there's a scene shot, I believe, in Tokyo, where in this movie, okay, it is a direct sequel to the Klaus Game of Death. The Bruce Lee footage
Billy Lowe, he's back.
The Korean stand-in Kim Tae-jung, who was a big Bruce Lee fan, and that's not really much of an actor, although he'd done some films in Korea, but he wanted to do the movie because he's just such a big Bruce Lee fan, so it was like a big kick for him to, you know, try to keep Bruce alive on film or whatever and be a stand-in for the footage. He plays Billy Lowe and the Bruce Lee footage, take it out of context. And then and they used the cut footage from Enter the Dragon that was restored in 1996 or 97 with the John Little, you know, dub over Bruce talking to Roy Chow that's in every print of Enter the Dragon on DVD right now, which is annoying. Yeah. But they used that footage completely out of context. And what's funny is Roy Chow did the pickup shots to act like his monk character is still in that film.
Yeah.
And then they have him doing a fight scene where a double jumps out in his robes. It's like fighting one of the Yun Clan guys.
I saw that. I was watching it and I was like, the timeline on all this footage is so confusing to me.
Right, right.
when was this shot? This part, there's Bruce, there's the guy, but then there's this. Okay.
Yeah. And then there's also a scene that's an outtake from Enter the Dragon where Bruce was walks into the Han guest room or whatever, and he's like looking or checking around for bugs or whatever, and then he sits down to write something. And they also inserted the scene that was cut from Enter the Dragon, just showing the servant coming in to tell Bruce about his sister dying at the waterfront.
Right.
And they turned that into a new scene in Game of Death 2. So it was directed by N.G. Yeah, who is a way better filmmaker than Robert Klaus could ever dream of being.
Absolutely. And I mean,
right.
That's one thing about this movie. If you saw Game of Death and you thought it sucked and you thought, well, there's no way Game of Death 2 is better. This movie's way better.
Oh, it's like, light years better.
The fight scenes in this movie are all redonkulously entertaining. Like,
they're great.
It's terrific. It's even though it has the same sort of thing as Game of Death where we're using old footage of Bruce and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. All the fight scenes I was riveted by. I was enjoying immensely.
Yeah, Yin-Woo Ping choreographed the fight scenes.
Yeah, and it shows.
Probably was pretty much the action director. This was after he directed Snake and Eagle Shadow and Drunken Master, which had shattered the box office record. So he basically goes to demotion for being credited as martial arts choreographer on Game of Death 2 and just turns in these incredible fight scenes, with the exception, and this depends on what print you have, in the international version, they have a scene that's cut from the first Game of Death with Billy Lowe and, you know, Kim Tae-jung, very visibly Kim Tae-jung, fighting Casanova Wong as a Korean fighter.
Yes, I knew Casanova Wong was going to come up on this show.
Great, amazing fight scene in the greenhouse. Actually, better than any Bruce Lee fight scene. Better than any fight scene in Game of Death 2, but if you have the international print, that it was directed by Sammo Hung, and it was when Sammo was really learning his way around editing and how to do a breakdown of a fight. And it's great. It's just a terrific fight scene. But in the international print, that greenhouse sequence, it was shot for the Hong Kong Game of Death. It was only seen in the Hong Kong version, but it was for the international print, it was inserted in the Game of Death 2 because it was part of the video. This was released on home video by Cinema Group Home Video in the mid-80s for the American market. And I remember renting it and seeing that scene and going, wow. And I think I'd read somewhere it was shot for the first Game of Death and you could only see it in the Chinese videotape. And that scene is terrific, but it's not in the Hong Kong version. It's not in the official Hong Kong version because it would have been considered redundant. So it's only in the bonus features of the Hong Kong Legends disc that I watched.
It's in the version I have. I have the Fortune Star release from the box set, the budget Bruce Lee.
Yeah, set. The Fox version, and I think I traded in my Fox version, kind of regretted it because it still had that scene.
Fortunately, I've hung on to mine, and now that you've told me that, I'm going to hang
on
to it.
Hold on to it. I like the Hong Kong Legends version, though. But they also have that clip on the as a bonus feature on the new Shout Factory Bruce Lee set for Game of Death. It's on that disc. Like, there's a really nice...
It is an awesome fight. I love it.
It's an incredible fight sequence. And then, so the rest of the film, Billy Lowe is killed, like, 20 minutes into the movie.
And we get more Bruce Lee funeral footage.
Right. They abuse the Bruce Lee funeral footage again.
Oh,
Billy Lowe funeral.
One thing I thought was hilarious about this movie was they have the little flashback scenes where they use clips from Bruce's childhood movies.
Yeah.
And the movie will stop and go, Bruce Lee at 6 years old. The movie, no, we're here to see Bruce Lee. And so the movie, and you know, this was before we had access to millions of Bruce Lee documentaries that show us all
right.
kinds of Bruce Lee footage.
Very
so,
true.
So when you were seeing Game of Death 2 and you saw that footage of young Bruce Lee, it blew your mind. You were like, whoa, Bruce Lee was in movies back then? What
yeah,
the fuck?
Unless you saw Fist of Fear, Touch of Death, which used some of that clip.
Oh, really? Okay. Well,
yeah, that actually came out before Game of Death 2.
But you know, it was probably a lot of people seeing that footage for the first time, but I love that the movie felt the need to stop and say, this is actual footage of Bruce Lee.
Yeah, it makes me wish I had not traded in my American version of that, but I could probably find it again for like $2 somewhere.
I thought that was great. Like, you have, like, this is actually Bruce Lee at 16. This is Bruce Lee.
Right, and then so so Kim Tae-jung is able to fill out the rest of the movie as Bobby Lowe, Billy Lowe's brother, and they don't have to do the whole silly footage, hokey footage usage thing, and which is great because it's like... It just becomes a straightforward action movie where he just ends up fighting. You know, it culminates to a big battle at what they call the Tower of Death, though it doesn't seem like a tower when they're in basically the same Golden Harvest stage set or sound stage as Eastern Condors had the missile silo, and Dragons Forever had the big fight at the end of the factory. And but it's him fighting Lee Hoi-san from who was the villain in last episode's Subject 3 Avengers, the Ho Jung Dao movie.
Mm.
And Lee Hoi-sun fights him, and then he fights Wang Jing-Lee, who was the Korean kicker from Drunken Master and Snake in the Eagle Shadow.
By the way, Roy Horan, who plays the American dude, is it intentional that he looks like Bob Wall?
I don't think so, but...
Because when I saw him, I was like, is that Bob Wall? And because he looks like Bob Wall, but not as beefy. And I went and looked, and it was not. And I was like, "Okay, it's this other guy."
Well, Roy Horan looked like that anyway. Like as far back as I've seen him in movies as early as like 70, I think, filmed in 75, 76. Okay. And he was a protege of Wang Jing Lee. And
I could tell he was an actual martial artist. I mean, he moved great, but I was like,
he and Wang Jing Lee were in the film, the Bruce Lai film, Ho Jung Dao, Story of the Dragon, and that I think that was Wang Jing Lee's first Hong Kong film, and Roy Horan got along so well with Wang Jing Lee, he became like his disciple for a couple of years.
Oh, really?
And then they both got on with seasonal films when they were doing The Secret Rivals and The Snuff Bottle Connection. And Roy Horan is actually in The Snuff Bottle Connection. And also he's the Russian priest villain in Snake in the Eagle Shadow. And he says that the only reason seasonal has good prints of Drunken Master, like for home video, is because he basically kept a 35mm print under his bed for years in his Hong Kong apartment.
That's
because he knew he's the one who said they needed to start saving their movies for home video release because he was like, they had this attitude, okay, the movie's running in theaters, throw it away.
Yeah, Hong Kong didn't care. They just tossed them out, you know.
Right, and he was the one who started trying to get them to preserve their prints. He's in the film, and I think he may have helped out with production.
And by the way, after seeing this movie, I am going on a steady diet of raw meat and deer blood dipped with bread. I was sitting there watching him, and I was like, is that Kool-Aid or is that blood?
He said it took them a whole day to find like a blood substitute because he was not going to drink. Like, they put, like, some butcher's blood in a... He's like, I'm not drinking that. He's like, go find me something that looks
like blood. He's sitting there dipping bread in, like... He's like, deer blood.
Well, you know, this is what's funny. His daughter is... what is her name? Is it... I'm trying to think. She's on Arrow. She plays, like...
Selena Jade.
Yes, yeah, that's his daughter.
Thanks, Wikipedia! I did not know that off the top of my head.
Right. That's his daughter. He helped her get that role in Arrow. Like, he helped her audition. I mean, she's a pop singer in Hong Kong, and I guess sort of a popular model or semi-popular model. But right now, bigger that she's on an American TV show. But that's his daughter. So
nice.
His roots in the Hong Kong industry were pretty long.
Wow. Because I didn't know who he was. Just watching.
Yeah, he's a prominent. He's kind of one of those. If you want to learn about what Hong Kong films are like in the 70s, he's one of those guys.
Well, she was in Man with the Iron Fists. Points against her.
She's poor girl.
I know. Not
well.
Her.
You know,
she just played a singer. She played. It says Dragon Inn singer.
Kind of a social media connection I have. He told me. He said Man with the Iron Fists. He cast the film. He said, we shot enough Kung Fu for two movies. He says, but somebody,
Roth's fault.
He said straight up what I guessed a year ago. He said, Eli Roth, I think, got in their ear and said, cut out all the Kung Fu. He says, I swear. He's like, we filmed so much stuff and that we could have filled out two movies.
That's a fucking shame.
And you don't see any of it in the film.
No, it's CGI action and gore. Like horror gore.
Yeah, and he said they shot a lot of Kung Fu. Just a lot of stuff, and none of it's there.
That's such bullshit.
Which tends to happen a lot, but it's just...
She's also in the show Arrow, which it's a big show right now, I think.
Yeah, she's Shadow or something on Arrow.
Yeah,
so.
Shadow.
Which, good for her. She's good looking. She's got some...
She's good looking. Talent. Her dad's
Her
badass.
Dad was in Drunken Master, and she talks about it, too. She says her favorite line in a movie was something her dad said in this film, so...
Oh, you know, really?
It was like, take them by the tombstones and convince them, or something like that. It's so weird. You know, one of those weird lines they put in there.
Well,
usually...
I thought his character was great in this movie. I was watching it, and I was just like, is that Bob Wall? No, that can't be Bob Wall. He's got too much personality, and he's not goofy enough.
And he has a physique. And Bob Wall, who I hear is actually still a very quick guy, had never really had much of a physique. So,
yeah, I mean, he doesn't show it off in Enter the Dragon.
Right? Well, he does in Game of Death, and it's like, dude.
Yeah.
Are you afraid to pick up weights? And apparently he was lifting weights at the time, but you cannot tell. But he does have the great line, Christ, Billy Lowe.
Christ,
but
Billy Lowe.
And then the whoever's dubbing Billy Lowe goes, you lose, Carl Miller. But Game of Death 2 was obviously they didn't want to repeat the Robert Klaus method of let's pad out the time with people driving around Hong Kong and visiting different offices and talking for 5 minutes.
Oh, it's horrible. Like, you know, that locker room fight was the only highlight of that movie.
Which is directed by Sammo Hung.
Yeah, not by Robert Klaus, because Robert Klaus couldn't direct a fight scene.
Bob Wall says he and Sammo Hung would not let Robert Klaus on the set when they shot that. So, but yeah, it's like, so Ng-Ya believes in just keeping the action going, and he has the Yun clan, like, in all these actions. What's so funny is it has, for the most part, when the Billy Lowe and Bobby Lowe characters fight, it's basically Kim Tae-jung's Taekwondo, and he's doing these really good high kicks, and it's very high kick based, which is what Americans like. They don't like animals at the time, like animal styles and stuff.
But
it's
there
like,
is a fight, a lion in this movie,
right? There is a lion, but also Yen Biu, before he was kind of more better known as an actor, Yen Biu is actually the acrobat double, just as he was in the first Game of Death. He does the flips for Kim Tae-jung, and it basically would at the fight of the end where he's fighting Wang Zhang-li, you could just see Yin Biao's face like several times pretty clearly. But
that's what's so funny about this movie is just switching back and forth between people. Like, it's pretty obvious,
I know,
but it's still entertaining. Like,
it can give you a headache, but it's like, well, a friend of mine, Bruce Hulichek, calls this the greatest movie ever made, and he's kind of right.
It's just awesome
because it's just nonstop craziness. And
like, I think a lot of people don't give this movie a chance because they were burned by Game of Death.
Yeah,
and this movie's
and
made
advice,
by
like,
people who understand this type of movie. You know.
It's funny because they'll have that kind of modern fighting with Kim Tae-jung's Taekwondo and Wang Zhang-li doing his Taekwondo and kind of faking some Chinese Kung Fu. But what's hilarious is then they'll stop and have a fight between, like, two monks, which will be two Yun clan guys, just doing traditional Kung Fu fighting.
Yeah, I know that scene you're talking
it's
about.
It's like such a contrast. It's like, wow, that's weird. But the guy in the lion suit was supposed to be a real lion, and they realized a lion wasn't going to be able to do the scene safely.
No, scene would have been a nightmare to direct with an actual lion.
Yeah, but so they just put a guy in a lion suit, and Roy Horan said he thought it was pretty ridiculous.
It's pretty ridiculous, and the thing is you can kind of make it work with a lot of quick cutting, But yeah. There are some shots that go way too long.
They were supposed to do it that way, and it just did not happen.
Well, there's just some shots where it was like you needed to cut like 2-3 seconds ago, you know? Cause,
yeah, right. It's just oof. But
it's like,
action,
whoa, that's a dude in a suit. You know, that's a
the
dude.
Action.
Like
is
the Cowardly
solid.
Lion's more convincing in The Wizard of Oz. You know?
Right, and when you watch the movie, you can tell it's a lot of it's made for the Japanese audiences because they have him walking around in Tokyo, and then they have like the Japanese singer singing, and even though that club, I think it looks like they went back to the Golden Harvest Studios to shoot all the inserts.
God, the club. The club made me think about how, you know, people talk about the 50s as the most oppressive time in history. I think probably the 70s, more oppressive to women. Just my two cents, especially in light of the Bill Cosby thing. I think Bill Cosby was doing what most celebrities did.
Oh yeah, I think they were all handing them pills. And, you know, I mean, good lord, with Jack Nicholson dies, what do you think what type of stories are going to come out?
Oh jeez, and I'm surprised Angelica Houston's been as nice as she has.
Makes you wonder.
I'm serious. Like I've heard all kinds of stories that like tossing out Quaaludes, like pouring Quaaludes down women's throats and having sex was like standard operating procedure.
Oh, it was like if you hear some stories about Robert Evans from back
oh
those,
god.
Good night.
You piss on me, darling. Thank you.
Yeah. And so the thing is, Kim Tae-jung, by the way, passed away a few years back.
Oh, yeah.
And there is an interesting Facebook page where somebody's putting up, I think, his personal photos. And maybe I'll try to tag one to the group after we record this to kind of give people a preview of what's going on.
Right.
But yeah, and also I'm trying to think of who else is in, like Roy Chow, who plays the Abbot. And the interesting thing about Roy Chow, and I've probably said it before, is he did a lot of the English dubbing for Golden Harvest in the 70s.
Oh yeah?
If you watch a Wang Yu movie from Jimmy Wang Yu movie from the 70s dubbed in English, it's usually Roy Chow doing his voice, including The Man from Hong Kong, the Australian production.
So question, are there any other movies of note that Si Young NG has done? I don't know how you'd say it.
Well, he did Bloody Fist. He did Bloody Fist in 73, which managed to get released on a budget pack from Warner Brothers, because I think they bought it off Garrow's old friends at Crash Cinema. And but the original print had all the stolen James Bond music, which made it so much more entertaining, because it was a cheap Chin Kwan Tai fights a Japanese villains on a beach type of movie.
And let's face it, James Bond music in kung fu movies makes them better, you know?
Right, and it was all stolen, and so the Warner Brothers video print, of course, completely wipes that soundtrack.
Oh, that's bullshit. God.
Gives it some synthesizer score or something. So, Inji Ya, he's credited with directing The Secret Rivals, which had Jun Liu, who was a brilliant kicker, you know, Taekwondo black belt, and Don Wang Tao, who and Wang Tao was a really good Taekwondo artist from New York who could do kung fu really well in movies. Like, you know, he could pick up the moves real quick and look like a convincing kung fu fighter. And the villain was Wang Zhengli, and that's what kind of made Wang Zhengli a star. Is he was this insane, you know, crazy kicker. And you got to remember, Chinese martial arts aren't really known for their great kicks. So to have these guys who were specializing in Korean kicking, it looked better on film. You know, it just looked better on screen. And Secret Rivals was a hit. Secret Rivals 2 was a hit. Inji Ya also directed Snuff Bottle Connection, which was promoted.
That sounds like a gross porn.
It's actually like this historical, you know, kung fu adventure, and it co-stars the actor, and I don't know his name, but he was the guy in Man with a Golden Gun that Roger Moore, I think, bows to and then chops in the head.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
He was a real martial artist and really good. He replaced Wang Tao as seasonal films. Inji Ya founded Seasonal Films.
Okay.
It was the independent. And then Inji Ya produced and let Yen Wu-ping take the director credit for Snake in the Eagle's Shadow and Drunken Master, which were the movies that made Jackie Chan a star. So Inji Ya had this great eye for stardom. And he and Roy Horan and the rest of the seasonal crew later made Ninja in the Dragon's Den, which brought Conan Lee to films. And unfortunately, Conan Lee, after making a great debut in that, kind of burned his bridge in Hong Kong for a while. You can go look more into that, I guess.
Well, that's because Robert E. Howard wrote him that way.
Right, and then they discovered Jean-Claude Van Damme for No Retreat, No Surrender. They produced that. That's an NGA production. And Corey Yuen, who later directed the Transporter film, or the first two Transporter movies. Well, I guess, does he get credit for both of those? I can't remember.
I think it's just the first one.
Okay, it was probably just the first one. But Corey Yuen, his directorial debut was Ninja in the Dragon's Den, and then he did No Retreat, No Surrender, and they discovered Van Damme. And then they got Van Damme to a contract, and then, of course, he broke it because it was a Hong Kong contract, and he went to make movies for Canon, but they did discover Van Damme.
That's crazy that, because I was like, I wonder what else this guy's done, and, kind of shaped a lot of the history of martial arts cinema.
Yeah, right, he did. He was a very, very innovative producer.
He's not just a guy who strung some archive footage of Bruce Lee together with some new footage, you know.
Right, and for Raymond Chow to ask NGA to make a sequel to Game of Death and make a good movie, and it's like he knew, okay, this guy is on the cutting edge of action. This is right before Jackie Chan was really breaking through and everything, and Sammo Hung hadn't quite found that style that was great in movies like Prodigal Son, and the Shaw Brothers stuff was kind of winding down. So NGA was kind of that guy you went to make the competent action movie that could sell overseas. And, he produced the Once Upon a Time in China trilogy with Jet Li as Wong Fei-hung.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Yeah.
It's basically NGA working with Chui Hark. And I think he produced, one of Chui Hark's early impressive movies, We're Going to Eat You.
Oh, I love that movie.
Which is a brilliant film. And, that's a seasonal production. So seasonal films and Seasonal produced one of my three favorite martial arts or kung fu films, Legend of a Fighter, which I think is just great. Like, I prefer it to anything Jackie Chan did. It's one of the all-time greats, and I love that movie, and it's unfortunately not available on American Home Video, but I think you can still find the Hong Kong Legends UK DVD that's worth grabbing.
I need to see that.
It's terrific, and it's Yen Wu Ping's best movie. Tugs at the heartstrings quite a bit, you know. It's the whole student teacher film where the student has to fight the teacher at the end, and it's a heartbreaker. And it's Yasuaki Karada playing the Japanese, teacher, and Liang Jiaren as basically playing Ho Yinja, the character who later is what Bruce actually what Jet Li is portraying in Fearless, and then Bruce Lee is avenging his death in Fist of Fury.
I'm glad to know that this is probably where the Metal Gear games I played growing up got all their plots from.
Very likely.
Those Japanese games with those types of plots, but with CIA spies instead of kung fu people.
Right, right. Old as the hills, and the Chinese kind of get the ideas from samurai films too.
Oh, absolutely. So it's very incestuous. Yeah.
Right.
Well, not incestuous, but they're.
It's a circle. It's a repeating circle of, just goes around and around.
Yeah, I've always heard about how Chang Che was influenced by Kurosawa and all that stuff.
Right, right. NGA was a here's a funny thing about Chang Che. He was greatly influenced by American TV westerns.
Oh, I'm sure. That doesn't surprise me.
Rifleman and Branded, and I think he specifically said Branded inspired One-Armed Swordsman.
That was one of Dave Brocky from GWAR's last tweets was, "Can we just talk about how The Rifleman is a fantastic show?"
It is. It's
great. And then he died.
Yes.
Oh. Wow. He said all he needed to say.
If you're going to watch something on your deathbed, watch A Rifleman.
Yeah, I think he was watching The White Rifleman and doing heroin.
It is a fantastic show. And the fact that it's very hard to get on DVD these days, it's a travesty.
So whenever I hear The Rifleman, I just think Dave Brocky. That was the last tweet. One of the last tweets.
That'll be my last tweet. If I'm
Look, we just talked about how The Rifleman is a fantastic show. You should just retweet his last tweet. Yeah. And then just like, all right, I think I'm about to shuffle off this mortal coil. Retweet.
Right, right. But this Game of Death 2 is, it's known as Game of Death 2 in America and in international markets. In Hong Kong and I think Japan, it was called Tower of Death.
Yeah, I saw the Tower of Death title bandied around on the internet.
Yeah, and as far as I know, it did not get a domestic American grindhouse release.
Really?
Did not. I can't find any trace of a American distributor.
I figured that would have been something they would have been, but you know, probably would have
World Northall. None of them. It doesn't look like anybody wanted to touch
you know,
it.
You know, given the influence that Game of Death has had on American pop culture, it makes sense that it hasn't, because none of those motherfuckers would give a shit about Game of Death if they'd seen Game of Death 2.
Exactly.
In those formative years, you know?
And also, the fights were very innovative. Like, it was shot in 79, but I don't think it was released till 81. But it's like the fight scenes were just like, you know, they were really on the edge at that time. And I think anybody seeing those fights in a theater back in 81, when the standard was like Chuck Norris or Kill and Kill Again, they'd be like, they would have had a heart attack. You know, there's such a thing as being too far ahead for people.
Like, yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
A listener of the show, he asked me, he said, you know, what if something like The Transporter came out in 1987? And I said, people wouldn't have liked it because it would have given them headaches. They wouldn't have been ready for it.
Yeah,
they
I mean, it's
the
like...
The audience, you could give them too much back then, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that it's like that music video aesthetic wouldn't have worked in the 70s, you know? Like,
no, not at all. People would have had headaches and vomit.
Well, it's like, what was it, like Highlander. People hated the style of Highlander, and then it was, like, imitated all over the place, you know?
Well, now it seems restrained.
Yeah, no, now Highlander seems subtle, but back...
So to 2 decades of Tony Scott, it seems very restrained.
Yeah, but when Highlander came out, people were like, it's way too stylish. Like, what is this?
I remember Leonard Maltin. Leonard Maltin shot his review for Entertainment Tonight with like 5 cameras. He goes, "What if you went to see a movie that started out like this and then was like this? And it just kept cutting to different angles."
But now it's standard. That's how movies are made now.
In retrospect, that was the most important movie review Leonard Maltin ever did for Entertainment Tonight. That and Metal Storm, the Destruction of Jared Sid. He's like, I don't want to pay $5 to have a mutant's arm thrown at me.
I do.
Leonard didn't. Leonard was a square man. But yeah, his Highlander review was classic.
I love that, was it on the Critic? I think it was the Simpsons episode with the Critic. They were like, did you know that the best-looking film critic is Leonard Maltin?
He's the most normal-looking.
My introduction to Leonard Maltin was him talking to George Lucas in front of on the Star Wars VHS tapes.
Really? I used to back when Entertainment Tonight actually covered movies, and not reality stars or whatever.
Right.
Leonard Maltin was their on-camera movie reviewer, and I think he did his reviews like twice a week, and I never missed him, like in 1983.
Yeah, that's what I've heard since then. But when I was,
because I love TV movies. Like there was just nothing else like that with this comprehensive encyclopedia of movies.
And TV movies, like, you know, those have like a lot. I think the audience for those, like yourself, you know, they're starting to come out, like, you know, with Warner Archive. You know, you're starting to see a lot of those movies like Bad Ronald and shit.
right. So Bad Ronald. But
Bad Ronald.
I had some Facebook conversations with Mike McFadden.
Scott Jacoby. Wait, what's his name? Scott Jacoby? Derek Jacoby?
Scott Jacoby's never
Scott
been
Jacoby's
better.
Never been better.
but I had a conversation with Mike McFadden on Facebook where we were talking about how we were hooked on the TV movie guide. And Mike McFadden wrote the Heavy Metal Movies book that is like, it's basically like a Leonard Maltin guide for the metal generation, and it's highly
you must read it.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Definitely order it, and I think you'll really get a kick out of it. and he has great expressions like grown men of the internet when talking about what.
Is he friends with Master Chim?
He should be. But the funny thing is, we were talking about the TV movies, and Mike said, I went through and circled all the movies he rated bomb because I wanted to see them. But I said, so did I.
Whenever I picked up a film critic guide, I always looked at the ones that had a turkey on them.
Yeah.
Or a bomb. Because I was like, well, I want to see what made such a strong impression that you hated it so much, you know?
Well, the thing is, in an early edition, Maltin gave Inframan a star and a half.
Oh, blasphemy.
So, and he also gave Five Fingers of Death a star and a half, which and basically just because the movie was dubbed based on his review.
Right.
In a later edition, he gave Inframan like 3 stars. Because I think he had contributors, and one guy was writing for Variety and was more of a specialist in B-movies and, you know, secondary cinema. And I think that guy overhauled a lot of his ratings for old films because Leonard didn't get it because he's a suburban white guy. You know?
He doesn't watch that stuff. He doesn't know how to consume those movies.
But what's funny is years later, Leonard wrote in an introduction, I really enjoyed a movie from Hong Kong called Iron Monkey. It's like, well, maybe if you'd been watching kung fu movies since 1971, you'd have known about this type of stuff.
I think this Donnie Yen has a potential to be a star. Maybe Guillermo del Toro will hire him.
Boy, these kung fu movies are fun. It's like, you know, so many critics wrote those off years ago. It's like, you know, it was like peasant cinema or whatever.
It's stuff for inner city blacks.
It's for ex-cons, you know, or it's for, you know, it's for kids. It's just silly, dismissive
crap. Only rappers like that stuff.
I still hear that today sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
But
I get at work black people coming in, hey, yo, man, you got any karate movies?
Well, that's the proper term.
I know, yeah. That's how I know they're real, is they call them karate movies.
That's legit, you know.
This lady was, she was, like, going around grabbing, like, she had this, like, handful of Jackie Chan movies on VHS. Mm-hmm. And she was like, do you know of any good karate movies? She was like this old lady.
In all honesty, the only people I really enjoy talking about old Chinese martial arts movies are like black guys. It's like they're great to talk to about this stuff because they're fans like me. They're really into it for a lot of the same reasons I'm into it. Like, they related to them. When you talk to like white nerds about this stuff, they're liking it because it reminds them of a cartoon or anime or a video game or something. It's not, they're just liking the action
or
scenes.
Or they go on about the philosophy. Oh, it's about the
right, and then
oh, Bruce,
and
Bruce Lee and the philosophy.
Like the black guys who are fans, we talk about this stuff, and they get the heart and soul of these movies or the humanity behind it. You know, that like a lot of guys they really dig about how the characters are poor. And fighting mm-hmm. against suppression, and they totally relate to it, and it's true, and not all the films are like that, but it's kind of, and there's this thing about self improvement, and that in the better films like 36 Chambers.
I was about to say 36 Chambers, like, you know, and this isn't a slight against Stu. I mean, this is a mistake people make when they watch that movie. But he was mm-hmm. like, I liked the movie, but I hated the final fight. And I said, well, you're missing the point. You know, it's about the journey. It's not about
The movie is about the journey. It's not about the revenge.
It's not about the end. Because if the movie was about the revenge, it would be totally undermining its message.
You know? Right. And but I've noticed with the old school fans, it's just like it's a different attitude when you watch this stuff. And that's when you find guys who dig something like Game of Death 2, because we get it. This was just meant to be. Let's make a little money off this Bruce Lee footage. We've got these outtakes from Enter the Dragon, but they made like a slam bang.
Yeah.
Live action comic book that's perfectly watchable, and it's hard R. There's like violence all over the place. There's nudity, really gratuitous.
Oh, like really gratuitous. Like that girl that the dude hooks up with, that white chick, looks like a clown. Like her makeup.
Oh yeah, the makeup's crazy.
Oh,
but
it's so bad.
She's just like Roy Horan said. She was a model. We found it at the Lanchai Mansion. I think it's what it's called, or Wanchai Mansion.
And her breasts are so fucking far apart; they're practically under her arms.
But she's legit. There's no silicone image. Like she's
no. She's a real chick. You know, like
yeah. And it's like Roy Horan said she was willing to do it. So you know, we felt like, you know, like the movie needed nudity. They wanted that for the Japanese export or whatever. Which is funny because years later, I rented the Japanese videotape. And because I found it at a store in Boston, and that was the Tower of Death print. And of course, her nudity was fogged in the genital region. So.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was funny that they shot a full frontal.
It is full on. Like,
yeah,
it
really seems out of place for a Hong Kong kung fu movie because you're just not used
to
it.
No, yeah. I mean, those types of movies are ones I feel comfortable showing to, like, you know, probably 13 and up most of the time.
Right,
but that
right.
one, I would have been totally caught.
I rented that movie when I was 15, and I flipped out when I saw. Or I think I was 14, and I was like,
"You were like jackpot!"
Yeah, I was like, "Yo, luckily I was watching it late at night. Father wasn't up, so I was like, "Whoa,
it's just,
but I was like,
dropping loads
because the American home video was uncut, so it was like Jesus, and yeah, you know, and you saw more in pan and scan, I swear.
You got more downstairs, yeah.
Oh, way more. And it was in your face. But it was just like, wow. And but no, like the movie was
I love the editing, by the way. We show a page of the Kama Sutra, then show her from the top up, and it's like oh, he's downstairs right now.
Right.
He's going, hysterical. He's diver down, baby.
Yeah, that movie's a riot. It's just like, but it really is like the ultimate exploitation Hong Kong movie.
It really is. And you know, it's so funny because like you were talking about, you know, making this movie with Bruce Lee. I was thinking about when I was watching this movie earlier. I was like, you know, when I was in college, I probably would have been like, oh, this movie is cynical, you know, exploiting Bruce Lee, you know, to make a quick buck, blah, blah, blah. But now I'm watching it, I'm like, I get some footage of Bruce Lee that I don't get to see normally, and it's thrown in with some kick-ass action. I'm happy. I don't care.
You right. Know? And another thing about the whole Bruce Lee exploitation thing, and this is where – like, I have literally heard a so-called martial arts movie expert say, like, that was, like, a bad thing for the genre and everything. Here's the truth about Bruce Lee exploitation. The people making it did not think in the terms of, oh, I just need to make money or we're going to fool people. They never had that in mind. I took a seminar from Dan Inosano, and I probably brought this up before, but I asked him about being in the Ho Chung Dao movie, Bruce Lai, as we know him, Chinese stuntman. And Danny said, oh, he goes, I did that because Ho Chung Dao asked me, and he's a really nice guy, and some people were giving me some static about being in a Bruce Lee exploitation movie, but I was like, it's just a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. It's just a movie. It's like, why if Danny Osama's not offended by their existence, why should you be?
Exactly. You know?
Bruce Lee's friends appeared in these films, Bolo and Unicorn Chan and all of his buddies.
Yeah,
and Man,
like, I
Michael.
Mean, Bob Wall was in the Game of Death, the other one with Rob Klaus,
which
is way more cynical than this
ironically,
one.
That's the worst of all of them.
Exactly. And, I was about to say, that one's way more cynical than this one, you know?
Right, and Game of Death 2, I'd actually say, is the best Bruce exploitation movie ever.
Absolutely. That I've seen, and I'm not an expert, but, you know.
But, like, Michael Chan Wai Man, who was friends with Bruce Lee, who I mentioned earlier, he was in some of those Bruce Lai films, like Bruce Lee the Invincible. It's just, they all, his buddies did the movie. This is just, like, it's just a movie. It's just, like, nobody's saying that he's, like, some superhero or whatever who could be imitated. It's just, like, you know, that's something that...
They're not sitting around a room going, all right, how do we make some more money off of Bruce?
And the funny thing is, nobody in Hong Kong really dug those films that much. Those were for foreign markets.
Yeah, like
foreign
you said, markets, this was for the Japanese market.
Foreign markets wanted those simplistic revenge movies and stuff.
I was going to say what Stu would call them, but I'm not going to.
No. We're going to have a it's a Stu-free episode. It's going to be a
Stu-free episode. I do not need to overcompensate.
Right,
to
exactly. No reason, you know. Don't need to go into Archie Bunker territory here.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But
Stuart's screaming it while drinking VB in his Holden right now. You
know? But there's something I realized where I was at a point a couple of years ago where I was thinking about maybe trying to write a Bruce Lee clone book or whatever, and then it was just like, it's going to be too much of a headache.
I was about to say, that's a lot of work. Right,
exactly.
There.
That's the thing, and I would want it to be like real, like legit, like crazy good.
You would want it to be, if anybody else were going to write a book on that, they would have to look at yours and go, fuck it.
You get intimidated. That's what I wanted. But the interesting thing is, I realized watching a bunch of like there's guys I couldn't stand when I was young, like Bruce Ellie, who I like to call Bruce Lur, who was one Ken
Bruce
Lur. Yeah, he was an actor who basically left the Shaw Brothers and became Bruce Ellie. And I was watching some of his movies and I realized how enjoyable they were. And I said, you know, I realized something with Bruce Lai and Bruce Lur and Dragon Lee's movies that I didn't quite hit on before. And it's like, they're the only genre of films that, no matter how cheap they are, they're trying to be entertaining in every scene.
Yes.
They are doing whatever they can to not bore you. Mm-hmm. If you are... in every scene, you're either seeing a fight scene, you are seeing something that's ridiculously funny because the dubbing is bad or there's slapstick comedy completely out of place, or you're seeing, like, cute girls or... You know, you get a sex scene or you get some exploitation elements. And you have all the stolen soundtracks. You're constantly hearing Midnight Express and The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. Music from Enter the Dragon, like, throughout these films.
Just
but
Turkish prison guards show up and just start beating the shit out of them.
They're trying to make the most anti-boredom movies possible. Mm. They're trying to be entertaining in every scene. And there's not a lot of these genres, like people talk about the Roger Corman movies and stuff. I don't see that level of focus of entertaining an audience for a quick buck the way I do in these Bruce Lee clone
films. Well,
that's
the thing is, like, I watch Boxcar Bertha and I can't even make it through it. And
it's boring.
And I hear about how, like, Corman said there's got to be this and nudity in every 20 pages. And I'm like, well, it didn't make the movie more entertaining.
No. And it's like these, to me, these Bruce Lee exploitation movies really fit the bill. They're doing whatever they can to be entertaining because they were pandering to the cheapest foreign markets. They were trying to get third world theater sales. And you just make the movie as entertaining as possible because you know the dub's not going to be good. Nobody's going to read subtitles.
The print's probably going to be worn out as fuck.
Exactly. So you want something enjoyable to keep people coming back. And people went to see these movies in the 70s and 80s. That's why I was surprised to find out Game of Death 2 did not get a domestic release. But most Golden Harvest movies in the 80s, Golden Harvest would not secure theatrical releases for their films. It's strange.
That is
strange. I often said they were sitting on these movies like they were a gold mine. And I always felt like they wanted... Raymond Chow thought a major studio was going to buy all of his films and release them.
He said, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they'll see.
Right, and he's like, he just sat on these things as if you have to buy all of them and they're all worth the same or something. You know, it's just a strange mentality I've never figured out.
Well, you see that with a lot of, like, I remember Battle Royale was a movie that didn't come to the U.S. for a long time. It was because Toei demanded that it be this massive release over here. They had bizarre, strange demands for it that were just completely unrealistic for
anybody.
What
happened with Battleship Yamamoto, the live action movie.
They
demanded, if you're gonna buy this movie, you have to release it in 1,000 theaters.
Yes.
And subtitled, and that wasn't gonna work. And then it ends up getting a quiet little Blu-ray release and nobody notices.
Yeah.
And but I kept thinking, I was like, you know, instead of waiting for some studio to find some white guy to co-star with Jackie Chan in a movie, because that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to do a Rush Hour type project as far back as 1987. They were trying to get Tom Hanks to do
Jackie Chan. Fuck a white guy, let's get a black guy.
Right, but that happened years later, and Golden Harvest had nothing to do with that movie. That's so ironic. And this is what I was thinking they could have done. Golden Harvest could have worked out a deal with one of these indie distributors, gotten their films into grindhouses, gotten the reputation going, get legit video rental reputation for these. You know, they would have gotten good releases on home video because they would have done well in, you know, the grindhouse theaters with the ethnic audiences. Eventually, the white guys were going to have to pick up on it because, you know, they pick up on rap later on. They pick up on breakdancing, whatever the hell. They're going to pick up on, you know, house party movies, whatever the hell. They're going to pick up on it, and they're going to want to see what, you know, these guys are checking out, and then suddenly you have like a very vibrant release of Jackie Chan movies, and we don't have to go to Chinatown to find our bootlegs. But Golden Harvest sat on these things so stingily and insisted these have to play in the white theaters and to make people like Jackie Chan. Yeah, it's just really dumb mentality.
Yeah.
And doing these half-assed American productions like The Big Brawl and The Protector. The Protector was barely releasable.
Right.
And just making these movies that just completely rob, you know, Jackie Chan, who I don't have the highest opinion of these days, personally, but back then...
What are you talking about? Jackie is a defender of the Chinese state, sir.
He's a defender of the elder, communist elders.
Yes.
But
Go see 1911. I don't even know what that's about.
I heard that was just awful, and everybody in the industry will tell you how bad that is, but won't say it in public. Mm. But you know, to do these American films that rob him of his cinematic gifts, and to not do anything that's within, you know, light years of Project A is just crazy. Project A should have had a legit good English dub release in the
Grand House. One of the great action movies ever.
It would have been pushed into the mainstream theaters eventually. It would have had to. I really think if people saw that type of action back then, they would have flipped out.
Yeah.
You know,
Raiders
it would have been
of
just,
the what? You know?
Exactly. I mean, it puts Raiders of the Lost Ark to shame. It really does.
No, it truly. I mean, that movie, there needs to be a better release of it domestically here, because it's a shame that like we have the Miramax whatever version.
It's a hack job. They cut out the music score and put a new dub on there that's worse than the old dub. I actually have the old dub on a Hong Kong Legends disc that I got from Australia thanks to a tip from Stu, and it has the original
version
dub
too. Yeah,
the original dub they did in Los Angeles, like in 1984 or whatever, and where they're doing thick accented dubs where they're doing giving them Chinese accents. Going, oh, we have the pirates! You know, it's the type of dub they could not do today.
And, oh my god!
But I thought those guys did a pretty good job. Actually, that's actually one of the better dubbing teams to work on the Golden Harvest stuff. I would say, you know, if you want to blame anybody for the fact these movies weren't big over here, and they'll blame racist studios or you know, closed-minded theater owners, I really think you can place the blame on Golden Harvest and their business strategies.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty accurate, just looking at a lot of the strategies from a lot of these studios. And, you know, and plus a lot of them treated their movies like shit, you know. They just, yeah. they'd throw them out there and then toss them in a warehouse where they weren't being cared for, and they'd just rot and decay on the shelf.
Right, they didn't think in the long term. And it's like, and Shout Factory's doing a really good job of releasing a lot of the 70s Golden Harvest movies.
Yeah, just put out a Jimmy Wang Yu set, didn't they?
It's great. And it's not,
I need it so bad. I want it.
They don't color correct the prints or anything. They basically get the Fortune Star prints and release them. But that's fine because they still look better than they've ever looked on home video because they've never looked on home video.
I'm totally okay with that because...
I don't think Golden Harvest really preserved their prints well anyway.
No, and when you start to fuck with it too, they start to look weird. Like, you know, they don't really look like... It doesn't look right.
It's like my wife was watching White Christmas tonight before we started recording, and they did a digital coloring correction. So Bing Crosby has like these insane blue eyes. It looks like Natasha Kinski in the Cat People.
Cat People. Oh fuck.
It's just like, what? Why is his eye so blue? It's like film in the 40s didn't look like this or whenever this was made.
Oh, my poor mother, she had me pick up the Blu-ray of that for her the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She loves that movie. She watches it every Christmas.
A lot of women dig it. And
I can't get into it.
Bing Crosby, but only when he's hanging out with Bob Hope.
Yeah, me too. I love Hope.
They're on the
Crosby.
Road to somewhere.
I mean, if it was the road to White Christmas, it would be great. But like, I don't know. When I watch it, I get bored really easy. It doesn't grab me. But whenever I'm forced to watch it around the holidays, like my sisters, my mom, like all the women love it. My dad and I are usually like beating our heads against the ground.
I think that's the movie's legacy.
I think it is, because, I mean, women love it. I guess that movie is one of those ones that illustrates the divide between men and women when it comes to movies.
Anchorman is the other one.
Anchorman!
Big Lebowski is the other one.
Big Lebowski, oh.
And pretty much every Golden Harvest movie ever produced.
Right.
But at least for American men. But yeah, it's like I would definitely I give Game of Death 2 like an 8 out of 10. I just think it's a riot.
Right there with you. I'd give it about an 8. I think it's way fun. It's just if you're one of those people who hasn't given it a chance because of Game of Death, like just shut the fuck up and go watch it. Throw your copy of Game of Death, like just put it aside. Watch Game of Death 2. This is where it's at. It's so much fun.
It is. It's a better live action comic book than anything I've seen.
It's
Marvel or DC films.
Absolutely. It's so funny and that's what I love about Bruce Lee movies in general. Like, I think Enter the Dragon's a better live action comic book.
It is.
You know? Like the villain, everything is just Jim Kelly, everything is so colorful and crazy in it.
I think the best live action comic book movie is Kid with a Golden Arm, which is not produced by the Shaw Brothers, not specifically made from a comic book.
Well, let us not forget Inframan. You know,
like, Inframan is the greatest superhero movie ever made.
Yeah, that's a great one. Five Element Ninja. God, that movie never gets old. I can't.
Right, there was a certain energy in Hong Kong cinema from like 1977 to about 84 that is just undeniably hyped up, supercharged. Ultra creative, unbelievable use of color and widescreen, fast editing. Doing the fast editing before James Cameron knew what to do with it.
Yeah.
Just like those guys were just on the cusp.
And they were cranking stuff out all the time, you know?
It was like a factory. I found out recently, God of Gamblers is a great Wong Jing movie, starred Chow Yun-fat and Andy Lau from like the late 80s, I think like 88 or so. I just found out that was filmed in 20 days.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. I found this guy named Joseph Kubi does these great translations of Chinese interviews, and there's a Wang Jing interview that's translated, and Gotta Gamblers was shot in 20 days.
It just goes to show how efficient this machine was in making these high-energy, highly physical movies.
These people just kept going. They had like a stunt crew. You go film some action over there. We're gonna go shoot. We're gonna film some acting. By the way, Chai Yun-fat's got to be off in 2 hours. He's got to go do another movie for about 6 hours.
It's like every aspect of the movie was like ordering pizza.
And Wang Jing learned that. That efficient work ethic. He said working at the Shaw Brothers studio in the early 80s.
I believe it.
Yeah, because he was working there in the days where they were starting to cut back. But he said he learned that work ethic and moving. You know, he said, you know, at any given time, they were revolving around 8 sound stages at the Shaw studio. It could be like 10 movies filming at the same time.
You know what Stewart's favorite Shaw Brothers movie was that was made in the early 80s?
What's that?
The Boxer's Omen.
Oh, yeah. He still complains about that?
Yeah, still.
I think the movie's a blast.
I love it. It's so good.
we were house-sitting for this professor up at University of Wyoming, and he had like a giant TV when those weren't as common. This is about 10 years ago. Yeah. And we watched it on there. And I just unbelievable fun.
It's so good. I don't know. Like, I remember making Stuart watch it, and he just would not shut up about how much he hated it.
Well, he's sensitive to certain images, like monsters coming out of the sea. So there's probably something in there, like guy
monsters breaking apart from someone's head and using their arteries as tentacles.
Right. It's an insane movie, and I'm not a huge fan of like a lot of the Shaw Brothers horror stuff. Is just too vicious. Like they did some Death Wish knockoffs. I just don't really care about.
I haven't seen any of that stuff.
But whenever they did like Chinese sorcery horror stuff, I always thought that like the Black Magic movies. I just love them.
Mm.
Plus, especially if you can get up with the Ted Thomas dubbing, then it's even funnier.
Oh my gosh, I need to. I think I saw the first Black Magic movie ages ago, but I might.
You gotta see Black Magic 2, man. Yeah, it is incredible. And it's a Media Blasters disc, so you gotta hunt for it.
Have you seen Corpse Mania?
Corpse Mania is okay. It's more like a Jalo or something done Hong Kong.
Okay,
style.
I was curious because it's by the director of Boxer's Omen.
Well, it's interesting. Boxer's Omen is a better movie. Right. Black Magic 2, though, has like Lo Li as the villainous sorcerer dubbed by Ted Thomas. I'm like, oh, you must bring me the virgin breast milk.
Gotta see that.
Oh, it's unreal. It's like crazy.
Seriously, scouring the depths of Hong Kong cinema is always rewarding. Like, it's pretty hard to find.
It's kind of all I'm focusing on these days. It's like I'm just going back and watching old favorites and trying to discover ones I haven't seen and just digging in. Because it's just like, man,
okay,
what's coming?
So, John, speaking of new movies, you saw Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I did finally see that.
Yeah. I think your assessment of it was pretty much the same as mine, but you made a really interesting point. I wanted to bring up on the show that I thought was insanely insightful. When I heard you say it, I went, oh my gosh, like he's absolutely right. You said that it had the Han Solo element that was missing from the prequels, the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah, they gave, and except this time they gave you 2 Han Solos and one of them's a talking raccoon.
Yeah.
And they gave you 2 Chewbaccas.
Yeah.
Because you have Batista and Groot, this Groot thing, and those were the 2 Chewbaccas. Mm-hmm. So they basically had that. Rogue Buccaneer Han Solo and Chewie element. It's just not in the last Star Wars trilogy.
And it was something that, like, in a movie like that, people were just starved for. And so, like, you know, they was like, this movie gave it to you in, like, in double barrels, you know?
It did. And I think that's why it was such a big hit. Mm-hmm. I really do think that's why it was a huge hit.
But, you know, in the soundtrack's great, too.
Yeah. And the soundtrack's fantastic. I still don't care for the film. Sorry. Sorry, everybody else in the world.
Yeah, but like you said, you said it has these things about it that are cool, but overall, I thought it moves too quick. It's just the villain's not that interesting.
No,
it doesn't allow much time to breathe. It sort of takes elements from the story for granted, like this kid was his mom died and then he was kidnapped into space. Well, it happens too fast for me to care, so.
Yeah, and it's also kind of disturbing. It's like, wait a minute, so when he grew up to be Star-Lord, did he ever go back and see his father?
Yeah, well.
And let him know he's okay?
Well, they implied that his father was from space.
That yeah, but it's just like, but then they don't even address it.
And yeah, they're like, the only thing they said was, and again, this speaks to the pacing of the film and how fast it moves that you can't pick up on these things, because I had trouble picking up on this stuff. Was,
right.
They said, like, Sean Gunn's character says, when he and Yondu are flying off, they go, oh, we never took him to see his dad, and he goes, yeah, well, that guy's a jackass anyway, you know, like,
yeah, it's just like, what,
it's like, oh, wait for the sequel, kids, you know.
Yeah, it's that typical Marvel making a half movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Marvel zombie half movie thing. I think these things are going to hold up so poorly in about 10 years. People
well,
are going
to
be ashamed
because,
to say
it's
them.
Because there's no way they're going to be able to tie it all up before the superhero bubble pops. You know
they can't. And I really think in about 10 years, people are going to be ashamed they said they like this stuff. They're going to look back on it like, oh god, it'd be like how we look at the Cannonball Run. It's like, ah.
Well, yeah, it's the junk entertainment of the day. You know,
it is. It's total junk fluff, and I don't pay to see it in theaters anymore, and just don't care about it. I suppose if my son wants to start seeing this stuff in about a year or two, maybe, but I just didn't know, no hurry to see any of it.
He might just to be able to talk about it with his friends, you know?
Possibly, yeah, maybe.
Because I remember when I was a kid feeling left out of conversations because I wasn't allowed to see certain movies and I wanted to see.
Oh, and I'm not like that. If he wants to see something, okay, we'll go. You know,
yeah,
if he wants,
yeah, no, absolutely.
And Spider-Man 9 or whatever the hell it is, you know,
Spider-Man
Sinister
9.
6, Aunt May.
And May, oh yeah, which I thought that was a joke, but apparently it isn't.
Well, I think the North Koreans have luckily destroyed any possibility of that happening.
I did see a new movie that I thought was great, though.
What was that?
Calvary, with Brendan Gleeson and Aidan Gillen and some other Irish actors. It's by the brother of the guy who did In Bruges,
mm-hmm.
and It's about a priest. The movie opens with a guy in a confession booth. Mm-hmm. The priest is in a confession booth, and this guy basically says, "You know, when I was a child, I was molested by a priest. You know, for years, daily, and he's dead now. And but that doesn't matter. I'm going to kill you in a week.
Uh-huh.
And it's not because you're a bad person. It's because you're a good person." Like, I just, you know, he's a person who's full of anger, and Brendan Gleeson plays the priest who hears this confession, and the movie's about the week before, you know, it's about his final week, I guess.
Well, you know, if they were both kung fu martial artists, it'd be a great golden.
Well, it kind of does have that sort
count
of kung
down
fu.
To kung fu.
No, well, like, because they meet on the beach at the end. It was very
a couple of flips and double kicks.
It was almost kung fu like. Like this dude runs up on the beach with like a revolver in his hand. But
oh wow!
But it was it's I don't know. There was something about the movie that was really refreshing because it had a lot of stuff in it that I don't see in movies today.
Right.
Just in terms of like philosophy and values that are typically tossed aside in movies. It's mm-hmm. sort of And when I say philosophy, I'm not speaking deeply. I'm just talking about in terms of living a good life
mm-hmm.
that I was really interested in. Like, and it did speak to, like, you know, Brendan Gleeson plays this priest in this community, and this community is so poisoned by everything, like, you know, abuse scandals and everything. It's just corruption, government, everything. It's just it, but it all just feels like this priest is just kind of absorbing the poison from the community. It was very interesting.
Wow. But I've always wondered this, and I don't know if anybody's got the stats, because I being a kind of ex-Catholic and you being a current Catholic, what are the stats of priest abuse as compared to public school teachers? Has anybody ever made a comparison?
That's a really good question.
Because I'm wondering, I would be willing to bet a pocketful of nickels that that probably they're higher among public school teachers.
I'd be willing to bet it is, too.
I mean, because okay, I grew up in a Catholic community, never heard about any priest abuse. Just heard about one that was gay and was seen at a gay bar, you know, 30 minutes away. Like, what, have found a better bar there, Father.
Yeah.
Go a little further. But he was spotted there. Now, but I never heard about priest abuse. But I did hear about public school teacher abuse.
No, the public school teacher abuse is, you know, I would imagine that's more common than we think.
Right, and I think it's this PC image in the media that
plus the Catholic Church is a big target on it. It's just right. it's always been something people go after, and you know, the Catholic Church is supposed to be this paragon of morality, and so whenever something like that happens, and the church handled it very poorly, like a lot of institutions, including public schools, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, somebody in that institution knows that person, doesn't want to see the person they know go to prison for the rest of their lives. So they hope, okay, well, they don't understand what that mindset's like. So they go, well, you got caught by me. If I send you somewhere else, you're going to do it again. Of course, they say no, and then they go and do it again. You know, and that because that's how they work. But the evil mind doesn't work like that. You know,
right? It was like the Penn State thing. Everybody's all shocked, and I was just like, okay, I figure this probably goes on in a lot of universities.
It goes on at a lot more universities too. You know,
right? It's like why are they so unique? You know,
that's a really interesting point. I'm gonna have that'd be an interesting thing to do some research on.
Yeah, if somebody wants to look up the math on that, it'd be really interesting, I think.
But hey, man, the state doesn't do anything wrong. They take care of us.
That's right. We've become the Soviet Union. What are you talking about?
What do you mean? This is the state. Right. You know, it's a few bad apples don't ruin the image of the state, which is the benevolent.
I think just the fact that we've gone from the Bill Murray as the top comedy star to Seth Rogen is
hey!
About how things have deteriorated. You know?
Hey! We need that as a drop. Like, we need to get drops on this show just so Seth Rogen. Hey! But not Seth Rogen doing it, you doing it.
I don't even know if he does it. It just seems like when
it
I
just
watch
seems like
movies,
something Seth Rogen does.
All he does is go, "Ay."
Oh. Well, I think we're probably out of show. What do you think, John?
We're
talking about Seth Rogen again, so we're probably
right. Not. Yeah, it's bad to go back around to that. But if you want to see Game of the Two, it is available from is it Fox Video these days?
CBS I guess I had the Fortune Star thing in the box set, the Bruce Lee box set.
That was put out by Fox, right? Or did you?
I think so.
It?
I think it's Fox.
Okay,
I think Fortune Star is a subprint of Fox. Maybe, yeah.
No, Fortune Star is actually a Asian corporation.
It is. Okay, well, I think
they acquired the Golden Harvest Library.
Yes. You're right.
Right, from Media Asia, and they're basically putting it out. They provided the Bruce Lee high def transfers for the recent Shout Factory box set, which does not include Game of Death 2.
Which is bullshit.
Yeah, I know. It's the big flaw of the set, but. Fortune Star is also they're the ones giving Shot Factory or licensing them the Jimmy Wang Yu movies, the Angela Mao Ying movies. They put out some really good box sets of old Golden Harvest films from the 70s that I think are worth grabbing. But yeah, you can see Game of Death 2 from the old CBS Fox Video. You can also get I highly recommend the UK Hong Kong Legends release, which I bought used from an Amazon dealer in the United Kingdom for like two great British pounds, which is like $4 American, and then of course like a $10 shipping fee, so it cost me a little bit, but you know, that's the way it goes
for the
that had a Roy Horan Bay Logan commentary that's really good, and also has deleted footage and nice bonus features. You know, like most Hong Kong Legends releases, they actually went all bells and whistles out for this stuff.
Yeah, I mean I'm sure you can get that Bruce Lee set for cheap if you're not willing to spend that kind of money just to see the movie, if you're not an extra.
Yeah, star. I've seen it cheap because the price went down as soon as the Shout Factory.
Shit, I think we have like individual the slim cases from them individually at my store for $1 a pop. You know,
people need to seek it out. Game of Death 2 is a great piece of exploitation.
It really is. You know, don't miss out on it because you have bad feelings about Game of Death. It's more
fun to watch in a little Shop of Horrors. Just
absolutely. It's more fun to watch than most movies, honestly.
It is. It really is. It's like, it's nonstop fun. Don't keep the kids out of the room.
Yeah, don't let the kids watch. It is not.
Unless you're Lena Dunham's parents, then you don't care.
No, then you don't care. And, you know, then talk to your kids about the rocks in their vaginas.
Right.
You know. It's normal.
Yeah, but highly recommended. Kim Tae-jung, rest in peace.
Yes. Stuart will, I think, be back next week. He just, he's been in Queensland. Mm-hmm. Which is why he's not on this episode, visiting the Queen, I assume. And but I think he'll be back next week.
He possibly will. I can see him sitting it out. Just because
it could happen.
I'm shipping a box of Bruce Lee Blu-rays to him. So
Bruce Lee.
Yeah, Bruce. Well, that's what Stewart will call him on the show.
You know, you just call him some slope on the show.
Oh,
there it is.
Broke the code. But
I was speaking about him. I didn't. It was not. Well, me.
Yeah, exactly. We were quoting him.
Yeah. So it's technically, it's not racist.
Right. Well, which means we'll probably be reviewing a Bruce Lee movie next week, for all we know.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll do an we'll. Because we can't seem to stay away from the subject of Bruce on this show, you know. We'll be doing Dragon in the near future, and maybe talking about how the introduction by Linda Lee on the DVD is longer than the movie itself.
Well, you know, if there's one episode that could get us sued, it's probably going to be the Dragon episode.
Oh, it's going to be so good.
The state will be after us because I'm about ready to unload. I got too much build up. I've been getting into too many arguments with these guys who love Dragon and think it's all true.
Oh, God. No, that
you
movie's...
should never disrespect Bruce's memory or Linda Lee's, you know, imagination about her husband.
No, the movie's such bullshit. I've talked many times about the scenes that I think are hilarious, but I'll save it for when we actually do that show.
Brandon! Okay.
You know, Bruce Lee really did hurt his back that way. You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I already hurt his back having sex.
Yeah, no, with somebody who's not Linda. You know?
That's what Linda's ex husband wrote in some book, Unsettled Matters. Tom Bleeker, he married Linda Lee and divorced, and then wrote Unsettled Matters based on papers he'd found in Bruce Lee's office.
No, he totally lost it in a fight, man, trying to open up.
The long term story was Bruce hurt his back doing Good Morning, those weightlifting exercises where you kind of deadlift dumbbells up, and like he injured his back lifting weights. That was always the story. The Dragon had it where he injured his back in a fight with Wong Jack Man, and then had a rematch with Wong Jack Man in a boxing ring. So it's just like, oh. God,
I thought he was double teaming girls with Roman Polanski, and that's how
he might have been. He was chasing women all over Hollywood in the '60s. All this nonsense about him being a good family man,
and he did hang out with Roman Polanski.
Yes, he did.
I'm sure he also hung out with Bill Cosby too.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. It
makes you wonder, dude. All right, guys. Well, that's it for this episode.
Yep.
I think go watch Game of Death 2. Don't ask questions. Just go watch it. And I think that's it. So, adios.
Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com, type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.